All right, this is the 11th lecture in the Staying Connected series, Selected Talks and Meditations by Rudolf Steiner. This was a lecture given in Berlin, March 26, 1916, called Trust in Life and the Rejuvenation of the Soul. The introduction. Underlying the soul qualities we have already uncovered, universal gratitude for the experiences of life and a sense of community with the world around us, there is an even more basic factor. This other aspect is universal trust, which might also be called faith or confidence in life. This is the rock bottom, fundamental conviction that life, no matter what, is always good and always has something to give us. Such a basic trust leads us to the Spirit. Opening to trust, we open to perceptions of the spiritual world weaving in this world. Underlying gratitude, solidarity with all existence, and so forth, this trust is all life, and in humanity and the earth provides the basic medium whereby the dead can communicate with us. Such trust, in fact, forms the basis in the soul of all spiritual cognition, while at the same time renewing the soul, making it healthy and in love with life, full of hope and expectation. Trust in life and the rejuvenation of the soul. Berlin, March 26, 1918. For the sake of continuity, we will first briefly go over some of the points in the previous lecture. We found that when we have something to do with relationships between incarnate and discarnate souls, the chief thing is to keep one's spiritual eye, as it were, on the quote-unquote air or psychic atmosphere that joins the living and the dead, so that a relationship can take place. We found, too, that there must be certain dispositions of soul among the living, since these in a way build a bridge to the realms of the so-called dead. Such soul moods always imply that a certain element is present in the soul, and when this element manifests in the corresponding feeling among the living, relations with the dead can come about. We went on to say that this shared atmosphere is created by the living through two kinds of feeling. The first may be called a feeling of universal gratitude for all the experiences of life. As I told you, the relation of the soul to its environment is partly conscious and partly subconscious. Everyone knows the conscious part. On this level, we respond with sympathy or an antipathy and with ordinary sense perceptions to whatever we encounter in life. Subconsciously, however, below the level of consciousness, we develop a better and nobler feeling than any feeling we are able to elicit consciously. This feeling can be described only by saying that in our subconscious soul we always know that we must be grateful for every experience of life, even the smallest. When we meet difficult experiences, they may certainly strike a painful note, but in a wider view of existence, we can be grateful for them in the lower, not the upper soul, thankful that our life is unceasingly supplied with gifts from the universe. This is something that exists as a real subconscious feeling in the soul. The other kind of feeling arises when we feel that we unite our own I with every being we have anything to do with in life. Our actions embrace other beings, even inanimate beings, and wherever we have done anything, wherever our being has been united with another in action, something remains behind. This remainder establishes a permanent relationship between our being and everything we have ever been connected with. This feeling of kinship is the foundation for a deeper feeling, one generally unrecognized by the upper consciousness or soul, a feeling of community or solidarity with the surrounding world. These two feelings, of gratitude and of solidarity or community with the environment one is karmically connected with, can be brought more and more to conscious fruition. We can raise up into our soul what lives in these feelings and perceptions, and to the extent that we do this, we prepare ourselves to build a bridge to the souls who live between death and rebirth. The thoughts of these souls can find their way to us only through the realm of the feeling of gratitude that we develop, and we can find the way to them only when we have become accustomed, at least to some extent, to nurturing a real feeling of community. Our being able to feel gratitude toward the universe makes it possible for a mood of gratitude to arise in our soul when we wish to enter into a relationship with the dead. And because we have cultivated this mood of gratitude, because we are able to feel it, the way for the dead to reach us is opened. And because we can feel that our being lives in an organic community of which it is a part, just as our finger forms a part of our body, we become ripe to feel the same gratitude to the dead when they are no longer present in the physical body, and through this feeling we can reach them with our thoughts. Only when we have acquired something of a mood of gratitude, a feeling of community, can we begin to apply these feelings in given cases. These experiences are not the only ones. Subconscious perceptions and moods are of many kinds. Everything that we develop in the soul helps to open a path to the world where the dead live, between death and rebirth. For instance, there is a very definite feeling that is always present in the subconscious and can be gradually brought into consciousness, a feeling we may put alongside the feeling of gratitude. It is a feeling we lose to the degree that we fall into materialism, although to a certain extent it is always there in the subconscious and is never rooted out, even by the strongest materialism. The enrichment, enhancement, and ennobling of life depend on such feelings being raised into consciousness from the subconscious. The feeling I refer to may be called a universal trust, faith or confidence in the life that flows through and past us, trust in life. From a materialistic standpoint, this mood of trust in life is very difficult to find. It resembles gratitude for life, but is a different thing, is a different feeling. It exists alongside gratitude. It consists in an unshakable mood in the soul that life, however it may approach us, has, under all circumstances, something to give us, so that we can never fall into thinking that life could have nothing more to give us. True, we pass through difficult, painful experiences, but in the wider context of life, these experiences appear as precisely those that do the most to enrich and strengthen us for life. The chief thing is that this enduring feeling, always present in our lower soul, should be raised a little into the upper soul. Quote, life, you lift and bear me, you make sure that I move forward. Unquote. If something were done in education to foster such a mood, a tremendous amount would be gained. It would be good to plan our education so as to show by individual examples that life deserves our trust, just because it is often hard to get through. When we consider life from such a standpoint, when we ask, does life deserve our trust? We find much that we would not otherwise find. Such a mood should not be considered superficially. It should not lead to finding everything in life bright and good. On the contrary, in some cases, having trust in life may lead us to sharp criticism of wicked, foolish things. When we have no trust in life, we may often avoid criticizing what is bad and foolish because we prefer to ignore things we have no trust in. It is not a matter of having trust in particular things. That belongs to another realm. One can have confidence in one thing and not in another, according to circumstances. The point is for us to have trust in life as a whole, for the whole content of life. If we can draw from the subconscious some of the trust that is always there, the way is opened to the spiritual, to observing the wise guidance and ordering of life. If we can affirm, not in theory, but with perceptive feeling, that life's manifestations, following one upon the other, mean something for us when they draw us into them, and have something to do with us that we can trust, then we are preparing ourselves gradually and truly to perceive the spiritual activities that work and weave in things. Those who lack this trust in life shut themselves off from these perceptions. Let us now apply this to the relations between the living and the dead. When we develop this attitude of trust, we make it possible for the dead to find their way to us with their thoughts, for thoughts from the dead can, as it were, sail to us on this mood of trust. When we have confidence in life, faith in it, we are able to bring the soul into a condition such that inspirations, which are thoughts sent to us by the dead, can appear. Gratitude for life and trust in life belong together in a certain way. If we do not have this general trust in life, in the world, we cannot acquire sufficient trust in anyone to reach out beyond death. All we have is, so to speak, the memory of our trust. We must realize that if our feelings are to meet with the dead, who are no longer in their bodies, these feelings must be different from the perceptions and feelings that go out to someone in a physical body. True, trusting those who are in the physical body will be useful for the conditions after death. But this trust needs to be strengthened by a general all-embracing trust, for the dead live under different conditions, and it is not enough to recall the trust we bore toward them during life. We need to call forth freshly renewed trust or confidence in one who can no longer inspire that trust through physical presence. To do this, we must, as it were, ray out into the world something that has nothing to do with physical things. The all-embracing trust, confidence, and faith in life that I described have nothing to do with physical things. Just as trust goes together with gratitude, so does the feeling of community, of solidarity, go with something that is always present in the lower soul and can be called up into consciousness. This too should receive more consideration than it does, particularly in the educational systems of our materialistic age. A great deal depends upon this. If human beings are to take their right place in the world during the present time cycle, they must develop a faculty that today must be cultivated not instinctively, but from knowledge of the spiritual world. We might say that we need to draw up from the lower soul something that in earlier times arose out of atavistic clairvoyance and did not then need to be cultivated. A few sparse remnants of it remain, but they are gradually passing away, together with everything else that stems from ancient times. In this connection, what we need now is to be able to refresh and rejuvenate again and again from the springs of life itself our feelings for whatever we encounter. We can spend our lives in such a way that after a certain age we begin to feel more or less tired, because we are losing the power of spontaneous participation in life, and are not able to bring enough zest to it for its phenomena to give us joy. Compare the two extremes, the seizing and acceptance of experience in early youth and the weary acceptance of life in later age, and think how many disappointments are connected with this. There is a difference in whether we are able to let our soul forces take part in a continual resurrection, so that each morning is a new experience, or whether in the course of life we grow weary of its offerings. It is particularly important in our time to take these facts into consideration, since they should influence education. Our judgment of earlier epochs is framed in the context of modern history, which is really a fable convenue of a peculiarly distorted kind. People do not realize that upbringing and education have been so organized in the last few centuries that what should be gained from them in later life is not gained. The most we have to show for the pains spent on our education is a memory. We remember what we learned, what was said to us. Indeed, as a rule, we are content merely to remember. No attention is paid to the fact that among the many secrets underlying human life, one important secret is relevant here. I have already spoken of it in previous lectures from another point of view. The human being is a manifold being. Here we will consider the human being as twofold. This twofoldness is expressed directly in our outward bodily form, which reveals a distinction between the head and the rest of us. I have introduced this twofold nature in order to explain the outcome of this duality. Our soul life, which develops under the restrictions of our bodily nature, is included within this duality. We have not only the organic development of the head and that of the rest of the body, but also two different rates, two different velocities in the development of the soul. The development of the head is comparatively rapid. That of the rest of the organism, we will call it the development of the heart, is about 3 or 4 times slower. The rule for the head is that it generally completes its development by about the 20th year. In regard to the head, we are old at 20. It is only because we obtain nourishment from the rest of the organism, which develops 3 or 4 times more slowly, that we continue our life agreeably. The development of the head is quick. That of the heart, which means the rest of the organism, is 3 or 4 times slower. We live our earthly life in this duality. In childhood and youth, our head organism can absorb a great deal. Therefore, we study during that time. But what is then received must be continually renewed and refreshed, must be constantly encompassed by the slower development rate of the other organs. All this is intended to throw light, only from a certain point of view, of course, on something that the lower soul always feels, but that is so difficult to bring up into the higher soul at the present time. It points to something that the human soul desires and will increasingly long for as time goes on. The fact that the soul needs something with which to continually renew its forces, so that we do not grow weary with the course of life, but will always be full of hope and able to feel that each new day is like the first day we consciously experienced. For this to happen, we must, in a sense, not need to grow old. Indeed, it is very necessary that we do not need to grow old. If today we see how many comparatively young people are dreadfully old, and how few regard each day as a new experience given to them, as to a lively child, we know what a spiritual culture must achieve and contribute in this realm. Ultimately, the feeling I refer to, the feeling of never losing hope in life, is the feeling that enables us to experience a right relationship between the living and the so-called dead. Otherwise, the facts that should establish our relationship to a dead person remain too strongly embedded in memory. We can remember what we experienced with our dead friends during life, But if we are unable to feel that we can always bring these experiences freshly to life when a friend is physically absent, then our feelings and perceptions will not be strong enough to experience the new relationship, for our friend is now present only as a spiritual being and must act as a spiritual being. If we have grown so deadened that we can no longer revive anything of the hopefulness of life, we will not be able to feel that this complete transformation has taken place. Formerly our dead friends could help themselves by coming to meet us in life. Now the spirit alone can help. We can meet our friends, however, if we develop this feeling for the perpetual renewal of life forces, so that our hopes for life always remain fresh. Here I want to make a remark that may seem strange to you. A healthy life, healthy particularly in the ways we develop here, will never lead people, unless their consciousness is clouded, to look on life as something they are weary of and sated by. Rather, a healthily fulfilled life will lead us, even in later years, to wish to greet each day as fresh and new. A healthy attitude will never induce an old person to think, quote, "Thank God my life is behind me," unquote, but rather, quote, "I would like to go back 40 or 50 years and live it all through again," unquote. And it is healthy when people have acquired the wisdom to take comfort from the thought that they cannot go back and repeat past actions in this life, but that in another life they will be able to improve on them. That is a healthy attitude, to regret nothing one has been through, and if wisdom is needed to accept that, not to crave it in this life, but to be able to wait for it in another. That is the trust that is built on true confidence and hope in life, actively sustained. These, then, are the feelings that properly inspire life and at the same time create a bridge between the living here and the living there. Gratitude to the life that comes to meet us here, trust in its experiences, an intimate feeling of fellowship, solidarity, and the faculty of making hope active in life through continually refreshed life forces. These are the inner ethical impulses that, rightly felt, can furnish the very best social ethics, for ethics, like history, can be grasped only in the subconscious realm. Another question about the relationship of the living to the dead frequently arises. What is the real difference in the relationship between two persons when they are both incarnated in physical bodies, and when only one of them is, or when neither is? I want to say something important about this from a particular point of view. When, with the aid of spiritual science, we observe the two highest members of the human being, the I and the soul life or astral body, we must say that they are not as yet far enough advanced for us to rely on them alone for power to maintain ourselves independently of others. I have often pointed out that the I is the youngest, the baby, among the members of the human organism, whereas the astral body is somewhat older, though dating only from the moon evolution. If we were here with one another, each only as I-being and astral body, we would be together as though in a sort of primordial jelly. Our entities would merge into each other. We would not be separate and would not know how to distinguish ourselves from each other. There would be no possibility of knowing whether a hand or a leg were one's own or another's. Of course, it would all be quite different. These comparisons cannot really be drawn. We could not even properly recognize our feelings as our own. The fact that we perceive ourselves as separate beings depends on our having been drawn out of a fluid continuum, that is, how we must picture it for a certain early period, in the form of drops, in such a way that the individual souls did not run together. We must imagine each soul drop enclosed as though in a piece of sponge. Something like that really occurred. Only because human beings are in etheric and physical bodies are we separated from one another, properly separated. In sleep we are kept separate only by a strong longing for our physical bodies. This longing, which draws us ardently to the physical body, divides us in sleep, otherwise we would drift through one another all night long. It would probably be much against the grain of sensitive minds if they knew how strongly they come into connection with other beings in their neighborhood. This, however, is not so very bad in connection with what might happen if this ardent longing for the physical body did not exist as long as we are physically incarnate. We might now ask, what divides one soul from other souls during the time between death and rebirth? Well, just as we, with our I and astral body, belong to a physical and etheric body between birth and death, so after death, until rebirth, we are part of quite definite starry patterns, no two of them identical. Each one of us belongs to a quite distinct pattern. It is out of this instinct that we speak of a person's star. Quote, unquote. The whole starry structure, if we take first its physical projection, is globular on the periphery, but we can divide it in the most varied ways. The regions overlap, but each appertains to another. Expressed spiritually, we might say that each region belongs to a different group of archangels and angels. Just as the souls of people here on earth draw them together, so between death and rebirth, each soul belongs to a particular starry pattern, to a particular group of angels and archangels. The soul is drawn there. The reason this is so, but only apparently, for we must not now go further into this mystery, is that on earth each soul has its own physical body. You will wonder why I say apparently, but research does surprisingly reveal how each soul belongs to a particular starry pattern, and other patterns overlap. Let us think of a particular group of angels and archangels. In life between death and rebirth, thousands of angels and archangels belong to one soul. Imagine only one of all these thousands taken away and replaced by another, and we have the region of the next soul. In this diagram, and there's a diagram where it shows soul A and soul B as two kind of clouds with angels, seven angels in the center, and one on the soul B all alone, and one on soul A all alone. Anyway, I didn't describe that well. In this diagram, two souls, with one exception in each case, In this diagram, two souls have, with one exception in each case, the same stars. But no two souls have identical structures. Thus human beings are individualized between death and rebirth by each having a special starry pattern. From this we can see how the separation of souls between death and rebirth is effected. In the physical world, as we know, it is effected by the physical body. We live in our physical body as though in a sheath. We observe the world from it, and everything must reach us through it. All that comes into the human soul between death and rebirth, with regard to the relation between the astral body and the eye, is connected with a certain starry region, in a way similar to the connection of the astral body and the eye with the physical body during life on earth. This explains how the separation between souls occurs between death and rebirth. We have seen in these considerations how we can work upon our soul to form certain feelings and perceptions, so that a bridge of communication can be formed between the so-called dead and the living. What has been said is also well suited to calling up thoughts. One might call them perceptive thoughts or thought-filled perceptions. That, in their turn, can have a share in creating the bridge. This will occur through our seeking more and more, when we experience something, to form a kind of perception that can call up in the soul the impulse to ask ourselves, how would my dead friend experience what I am experiencing at this moment? By creating the imagination that the dead friend is experiencing the event side by side with us, and making this a really living feeling, we can form some impression of how communication arises between the dead and the living, on the one hand, and on the other, between the dead themselves. If we also consider how the various starry regions are related to our own souls or to each other. In this way we can gain a feeling for the influences that play from soul to soul because of their relation to certain starry regions. If we concentrate upon an immediate interest, mindful of the presence of the dead, and feel the dead living close beside us, then from such things as I have discussed today, we become more and more conscious that the dead really do approach us. The soul will develop an awareness of this. But we must have confidence that these things really are so. For if we lack confidence and are impatient with life, another truth prevails. The good effects that confidence can bring are driven away by impatience. The enlightenment that comes through confidence is darkened by impatience. Nothing is worse than letting impatience conjure up a mist before the soul. The end of Lecture 11.